Hold it open so I can see it. Hold it up. Oh, it's a 3DS.
And oh, God, you got a 3DS.
And a Mr. Potato Head. That's what you wanted for Christmas.
No, a 3DS game. This is not food that we get used up today. It's so fair that you give us the award. I'm going to just throw this away.
That's what you wanted, Sean.
You gave me the board to stop. And you guys are such the worst. I hate it.
Jack likes his present.
He got the best. I got the worst. It's not fair.
You like it?
Yeah.
Don't you just love those kids? The one is so honest about it being the worst and is angry at his parents, and the other one is like, a potato! The best ever! Yeah, you get really hooked on watching those videos. You keep looking at different kids' reactions, but I have to say, when you start watching them, you see these kids have some pretty big tantrums. And you kind of watch, and I felt like I was like, I'm watching these children have meltdowns, and I started to be a little bit judgmental, and I was like, wow, these kids are super spoiled, because a gift is something extra, right? Something that's given, something you didn't expect, you don't really possibly ask for or deserve. And so who are the kids to complain if they get a 3DS or a sponge, which some of them get, or a hammer or a potato or socks and underwear? But my question was this, as I was watching this, I was like, do we really change as adults? Maybe we don't have the tantrum, but how often do we find ourselves after Christmas standing in customer service with our receipt in the one hand and our gift in the other, and we are on our way to give back what was given to us? So maybe we don't have the overt tantrum, but we have maybe found a more sophisticated way of returning the gifts that were given to us. And there was an article published, when I started to do research on this, in 2015, titled, A Growing Holiday Pastime, Returning Those Unwanted Gifts. Really? A growing holiday pastime, returning unwanted gifts. So in the same way that the Christmas experience includes carol singing and turkey dinner, it now has also come to expect that you will at some point stand in line and return your gift. Apparently, because the numbers don't lie. Business Insider estimated last year that people would return up to $90 billion worth of unwanted gifts. But another article published actually suggested that the number was closer to $280 billion. And if you don't want to or can't return your gifts, one newspaper reported that about $80 million are generated on eBay through resales gifts. So as much as we don't want to acknowledge that we return gifts, we do that. Even if we want or need them, the truth is we return them. And I would argue that actually return is a bit of a positive understatement. It's a euphemism. Because actually what we are doing is we're rejecting the gifts that's given to us. We don't want them, so we return them. That is literally the definition of reject. The definition of rejection or reject is to not accept something, to not keep something, to be unkind to someone, or to turn somebody down. So perhaps the more accurate and truthful is not gift rejection, but gift, or gift return, but gift rejection as a good Christmas pastime. Because I know that word rejection actually provokes a lot of strong feelings, and I think it should. I'm doing it on purpose. I'm using it this morning on purpose, because I think we've all experienced rejection at some point. And our association with rejection is rarely, if ever, positive. If you can think of a positive experience of rejection, do come tell me. The 9 a.m. service couldn't, so you could win. We experienced different types of rejection growing up. Now, I can only speak for myself, but one of my experiences of it was being in the form of being bullied from grade 6 to grade 11. It was almost daily by people. I was just so desperate to be included. At an age where you really want to please others and call them your friends, I instead experienced name-calling, was the recipient of jokes and innuendos to this day. Honestly, I still don't fully understand. That resulted in a lot of loneliness and isolation. And I have a very vivid memory of walking down my high school hallway while some boys threw things at me as I walked through the middle. Bullying was my experience of rejection. Maybe it's yours or it's your kids. And maybe it didn't happen as overtly as mine did. It could have been rejection simply by being ignored. Maybe you were excluded, rejection by exclusion. Or maybe you were rejected for the team you tried out for. So whether it was the debate team, the sports team, you ran for student council, you tried out for the band, you didn't make it, you were rejected. Or maybe you applied to a program in university or college, you didn't get in, so you're rejected. Or maybe eventually you applied for a job that you really wanted and the position when you got the call went to a more qualified candidate, you were rejected. And then likely at some point along the way in relationships, you were rejected. People who you wanted to be friends with didn't want to be friends with you, or a person that you were interested in didn't return the favor. You were rejected. And then maybe also you've been rejected due to the way that you look. So maybe it's your height or lack of height. Maybe it's your weight. Maybe it's a disability. Maybe you experience rejection due to the color of your skin. Maybe you experience rejection due to the color of, or your gender. We all experience rejection. I think it's part of the human experience. And it's a painful experience. Science indicates actually that social rejection, relational pain, and physical pain are actually felt in the same part of the brain. That is why it actually hurts when we are rejected by someone or something. In a study done on the psychology of rejection, two groups were asked to recount a rejection experience, but one group was given Tylenol and one group was given placebo, and they didn't know who was given what. But the group that was given Tylenol was actually reported their level of pain is lower than the group that was given placebo. Rejection actually has a physical impact on our brain, and so that's why it actually hurts when we are rejected. Twitter did a survey in which they asked their followers if they would rather break their arm or get broken up with. 75% of people would rather have their arm broken than get broken up with, which seems high, but I also think as we're sitting there and watching all your faces go like, oh, rejection, like you just see everyone deflate. I can understand why we'd be like, rather get our arm broken than get broken up with. Rejection is very much part of the human experience. I think by the time we get to adulthood, it would be surprising if any of us haven't experienced this at some point. And so it really isn't that much of a surprise that when we're looking at the Christmas story, there's actually a thread of rejection throughout it too. We just have to look at it. So I'd like you to turn with me to Matthew 1, which is read earlier. Because before Jesus even makes it to earth, there is rejection in his family's genealogy. It's part of his backstory. We're going to see how I think those who would likely reject him, society would reject at the time, actually God chooses. And so Matthew's genealogy, if you remember or recall that Matthew is actually a Jew writing to Jewish audiences. And so he's writing about Jesus' backstory. And so if you look in verse 1 there, he says, the book of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Let's just pause there and talk about David. And then look at verse 2. So Abram was the father of Isaac, and Isaac was the father of Jacob, and Jacob is the father of Judah. Let's pause there. Jacob is actually the younger brother. Remember, Esau's his older brother. He's actually supposed to be the one that's found in the genealogy. He is the oldest. He's the heir. Jacob is the spare, right? He's the reject. And even by his dad, Isaac favors Esau over Jacob. Jacob would have known what rejection felt like, and it's actually with deception, with Rebekah, his mom, that Jacob actually gets the blessing of his father, Isaac. So right away, as we start to list off these things, we see that someone was actually rejected by his own dad, and only with, you know, his deception did he end up part of the story. But God chooses to use it too. The second thing is for Jacob, growing up being not dad's favorite, you also think maybe it would make him more sensitive to playing favorites. Not so much, because now we need to think about his wives. Jacob loved who? Rachel. But he was married to Leah and Rachel. Now, if we look at Jacob being the father of Judah and his brothers, Judah's mom is Leah, not Rachel. So Jacob himself has his own experience where he you know, rejects his second wife. It's very blatant in the story that he loves Rachel over Leah. And who does God elect to be part of Jesus' genealogy? It was Leah's son, the less loved wife of Jacob himself. And then if we read on, so there we have, there, you know, that thread starts right at the beginning, but then I just want you to look at verse 6, and where we talk about Jesse's the father of David the king. So we're going to come back full circle to David. Jesse's the father of David the king. Now, if you were here a couple weeks ago, 1 Samuel tells a story of how David was anointed king, but his own dad didn't even get him in from the field. He was like, oh, Samuel shows up and is like, I'm supposed to anoint one of your sons. And so what does Jesse do? I'm going to call in my sons, but I'm not even going to bother with the shepherd boy. He's out doing the same. His own dad rejects him as an option for king. But that's the one that God picks, right? Because he looks at his heart. So in human eyes, we see rejection as part of this theme. But here's the interesting thing that Matthew does in verse 6b with David. So David's kind of the, you know, the reject by his dad. But then David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. Let's pause there. David's the father of Solomon by the wife. Why didn't you just call her Bathsheba? He mentions other women here. Why does he do by the wife of Uriah? Oh, by the way, there's this little deal that happened with Uriah. Remember when David slept with Bathsheba, who just also happened to be married at the time to Uriah, and then there was this whole scheme of putting Uriah in a place where he ended up dying on the front so that David actually could have Bathsheba. So the Jews are reading this, and remember, they're an oral culture. They would remember this story. David is not the most moral person. He would be, based on, you know, the think line of royalty, an obvious rejection based on his own actions. And yet he's included as part of the genealogy. One more thing I would like to point out to you, if we're looking at the threat of rejection or using outsiders in Jesus' story, is that in the genealogy listed here, there are five women listed. Now, this may not be significant to you, but to the Jews reading this, where it's a patriarchal society, the purpose is to name the men. Women were basically part of the estate, part of the household. They were, you know, gender outsiders. And yet, five of them are listed in this chapter. Not only that, but three of these women are Gentiles. And for a Jew reading that, we know some of the history, the ways that Jews viewed the Gentiles was they were racial outsiders. They were rejects. And yet, Matthew is telling us they're part of Jesus' backstory. Furthermore, there's one specific woman who's mentioned, and her name is Rahab, and she's mentioned in verse 5. So she's mentioned there, but also Rahab was a prostitute. So we have a moral outsider, a moral reject, and she's a Gentile, racial outsider, and she's also a woman, so she's also a gender outsider. And she's mentioned as part of this too. So there's three reasons that Rahab could be rejected as a choice to be part of the line of the chosen one. And yet, she is part of the line. And so we see here the Jews reading this would have known that these stories are people who could have been rejected for any number of reasons. Yet they are part of Jesus' backstory, part of his family history. And I think, you know, maybe they're reading this like, God, you could have picked better people. You know, society would have picked better people. We would probably pick better people. But instead of rejecting these people, God invites them into his plan. Matthew starts off his book to his Jewish audience, reminding them that the chosen one's family is not only super dysfunctional, but involves a large group of people who would have experienced rejection at the time and even by their own readers. Racial outsiders, moral outsiders, gender outsiders, people who would have been set aside, they would have been cast aside, they would have been rejected by the people in their day and their readers of this book. Rejection is very much part of Jesus' genealogy. We're also going to see that rejection is very much part of Jesus' parents' experience as well. When they receive the news that they are going to be favored, this actually has a very transformative experience for them, but we're going to slow it down a bit. So I want you to turn to Luke 1:26, because I think oftentimes we may glamorize it a little bit, and we're going to slow it down a bit this morning. And we're introduced to Mary and Joseph in verse 26 of our text this morning. And I just want to set up the scene for you because I think we may sometimes think they're older than they were. It's likely that Mary was 12, 13, or 14 years old. So if you want to think of a youth, some young person, maybe it's a cousin, maybe it's one of the young women who are up here, this is the person that God picks, young Mary, teenage Mary, okay, to come. And Joseph is likely 16 or 17 years old, so he's also very young, teenager, and like, just so think in your mind, give them a face, someone you know who's around this age. And so these are very young people, and this is the scene, so put those faces in your mind, and then the angel comes, we read in verse 26, Gabriel sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David. So let's just pause there and talk about that betrothal, because I think we're easily going to think betrothal, oh, they're engaged, and we kind of know what that means. The ancient Jewish marriage process actually is very different from ours. There were three stages. The first stage is an engagement process, and this basically was when the father of the groom and the father of the bride had a meeting and were like, we want our families to be in a, like aligned. And the strongest way that this can happen is through a marriage between our son or daughter. The bride and groom would actually have very little say, very little involvement in this plan. Likely, this also meant that the families were very invested in the success of this marriage because it didn't just have implications for the bride and groom. It had family implications for like either estate or alliances or whatever. So that happens, but nothing has actually exchanged between the bride and groom. Then we get the second stage, which is betrothal, and that's the word used in our text. And this is a marriage ceremony in which the bride and groom exchange vows in the presence of family or friends. And at this point, they've exchanged vows, they're considered legally married, and their marriage could only be broken by divorce. But this stage is different because at this point, the bride and groom still are not allowed to be left alone together. Their expectation actually even after this ceremony is that they go back and live in their parents' homes. But what it does is it marks the beginning of a process for the groom in which he starts to build a home for him and his bride and also pursues a profession so that he can sustain the household. So this is the path that Joseph is on. This is where Mary is. But let me be clear here. They were not allowed to be sexually intimate at this time. They were not even allowed to be left alone. They had to wait until the third and final stage, and that was the feast. So this is the last feast. It would be held when, or the last phase, and the feast would be held when the groom's preparations were complete. He basically would get all his homeboys. They would go to the bride's house where she'd be hanging out with her girlfriends and they would start this parade through the village. And it was just an announcement that we're ready. We're going to do this thing. There's a big party. Everyone is invited. And this festivity could last from, you know, a day to a week. And at the end, basically the best man, if you want to call him that, puts the bride and groom together and says, go, you can be alone now in all the ways that you want to be alone. Okay. So they have not actually reached this phase yet. But the ship has sailed. Joseph and Mary are two-thirds into the way of this process. Really, just the public celebration is left. But what this also means is that their family and friends, and likely the town, are aware that this feast is happening. They would have seen Joseph around. They would have known this is going to happen. They're just waiting. And then verse 39, we read that Mary gets this revelation from Gabriel. She gets this revelation from Gabriel. And she goes in haste as a result of it and visits this her older relative named Elizabeth. And she stays with Elizabeth for 3 months. Now, I don't know if this is part of the divine plan to affirm that Mary's pregnancy actually doesn't involve Joseph at all. We just know they're apart for 3 months. And what we do know is by the time she comes back home, by the time she comes back to her family, she's for sure pregnant. So let's pause there and let's just talk about Joseph for a second because all this is going on in Mary's world. He's blissfully unaware of what is happening with his bride. She's going to drop a bomb on him. You see, Mary is technically pregnant and Joseph knows we haven't finished anything yet. And for us today, pregnancy outside of a covenant contract, outside of marriage, it's while we may not like it, we're not surprised by it. But God's vision for marriage and even this process is that pregnancy is a byproduct of that intimacy and commitment. for Mary and Joseph, that hasn't happened yet. And everyone in the town is going to know that because they haven't yet been invited to the feast. Did we miss the feast? They're all going to wonder. That final stage where husband and wife are allowed to be together. So Mary comes home from visiting Elizabeth. She's gone for 3 months, but shortly afterward, she starts to show. She's pregnant. And everyone's about to find out. It's not something you can hide. 13, 14, 15 years old, teenage pregnancy, outside of marriage, just doesn't bode well. And Joseph, by his association as her betrothed, is either going to be implicated as the father, or Mary's been unfaithful to him, and that's going to bring shame on him. They're going to experience rejection due to this favor, this gift that they've received, and it's going to cause a lot of heartache. Now, here's the thing. I think we need to use a little bit of our imagination as to what this process, that 6 months, could have looked like for them. Because we get kind of this glossed over, here are the events, but I wonder if walking through their story as, you know, 13 years old and 16 year old might be helpful for us to understand their experience. So imagine with me, 13-year-old Mary. She walks down the street to pick up bread from the local baker. This is a walk she's done hundreds of times. But as she goes down the street, those who she had formerly said hello turn their back as she approaches. And her waddling figure, going slowly, she's uncomfortable in the heat, and even more so due to her pregnancy. Imagine that at a time when she would need her friends to support her, instead the room falls silent when she shows up. Imagine the playmates she used to collect water with or sit in the shade with and talk with were suddenly busy whenever she was around. Imagine 17-year-old Joseph learning to be a carpenter, instead shows up to his apprenticeship one day and is asked to leave because no one wants to give business to his master. Imagine Joseph trying to build a home for himself and suddenly no one sells him any more materials. He can't finish the job. And whereas once his groomsmen would come and help him when they had free time, Joe instead finds himself working alone. Imagine this couple, once planning a party for the whole village to celebrate, now is a party where they can't even fill their yard because some of their own relatives refuse to be associated with them. They're rejected. This is very likely part of their experience. And do you think Mary's going to run and be like, an angel, I'm pregnant by the Holy Spirit? I don't think that's what she's going to do. I think rejection's very much part of probably Joseph and Mary's experience. And then to top it all off, by the time the baby comes, there isn't even any room for them in the inn. Do you think that they may have wanted to return this gift of favor? Do you think at times they didn't wrestle with understanding how the rejection they experienced, being cast aside, set aside by friends and maybe even family in the world, was somehow a result of God's favor? I think they did. Mary and Joseph were both human. They're both imperfect. They're both teenagers. And they very likely experienced what it was like to be set aside, cast aside by society, even by friends and family. And then by the time Jesus' birth comes, no room for them in the inn. And who do the angels appear to? Shepherds. The lowest of the low jobs in Jewish times. A rejected profession. And this is who the angels appear to say, oh, the Messiah's come, the chosen one has come. Rejection is very much part of Jesus' process, his parents' process, his genealogy of coming to earth. And then Jesus' experience on earth, I'm not going to go into it because we're focusing on Christmas, but I just remind you that Jesus' experience was all about him being the recipient of rejection. For the message that he taught, for the fact that as a man he chose to touch the unclean, he chose to touch the sick, he healed on the Sabbath. He cared more about personal freedom for individuals than the national pride of the Jewish nation. And we're told that he was rejected by men. And as a prophet, he wasn't even welcome in his own hometown. And we know that this hatred of him, this rejection, would eventually result in his being led to the cross. and the ultimate death. If anyone could understand and resonate with the human experience of rejection, it's Jesus himself. Now, I don't know about you, but I've heard this story like hundreds of times. I think I've read Matthew's list and like Luke's version. Like, I could probably recite it in my sleep. But for some reason, I had never really seen this thread of rejection in the Christmas narrative. And yet the truth is, I think when you look for it, it's there. It's part of the human experience, but also it's part of the backstory of Jesus. But the truth is, it's there. And yet, it's also not there. Because to reject, if I remind you, means that you have to not accept something. You have to not keep something. You have to turn somebody down, meaning that on the other end of rejection is a giver. On the other end of rejection is a giver, someone who has offered something to you. And if we forget that the giver is actually part of the story, then we only see not even 50% of it. Because as much as the receiver's experience is important, it is actually the giver that needs just as much of our attention. The giver needs our attention for a number of reasons. And so as we start to talk about the giver this morning, I'm gonna ask you to stick with me while I use an illustration. Why is the giver important? The giver has a very special role in giving a gift. In order to see and help us start to think about this, I want to use a movie clip of something I saw a couple years ago. The movie's called The Perk of Being a Wallflower. Now, for the sake of time, I'm not going to go into the full context of the movie, but there's a scene in which the wallflower, so it's this young teenage guy in high school, a really nice guy, really sweet guy, he asks his teacher why this girl that he likes continues to date guys who don't treat her very well. And although I often don't ascribe wisdom to Hollywood, I think the teacher's answer is so profound, it's actually worth us taking a minute to watch this scene. So we're gonna watch this scene as this exchange happens.
Wow, that was fast. You want another one?
Yeah.
All right.
Mr. Anderson, can I ask you something?
Yeah.
Why do nice people choose the wrong people to date?
Are we talking about anyone specific?
Well, we accept the love we think we deserve.
Can we make them know that they deserve more?
We can try.
We accept the love we think we deserve. We accept the love we think we deserve. And so we reject the love of the gift that's offered to us. We reject the gift that someone else thinks that we need, and perhaps even maybe deep down we want. You see, to be a giver requires us to tell someone, offer someone a gift, what we think they need. And this requires a type of courage. In 1 John 4, we're told that perfect love casts out fear. And I think this has great significance when we apply it to our experience, right now our illustration of rejection and relationship. You see, when someone is courageous enough to put themselves out there, so to speak, they have actually moved to a new place of love. Their ability to love the other is greater than their fear of being rejected or their fear of being found flawed. There is in the giver the confidence that what they have to offer the other person is something special and valuable. It's the type of gift that says, I believe that this is what you need. It may not be what you want, but I think this is what you need. And in the case of a relationship, I believe I am or I have what you need. And I love this because the wallflower has the confidence in himself to believe that he has the love this girl needs and doesn't yet know she wants. The giver has the confidence, but also probably the clarity to offer something to someone who doesn't yet know that they need it, and maybe actually doesn't even know that's what they want. And so you're hearing this scene, and you kind of think, is that girl crazy? It's a nice guy. Like, why would she choose broken relationships over this steady love of this wallflower? Why would you walk away from a good gift? Why would you reject a gift? Seems crazy, except when you think about a couple of reasons that actually work itself out in our own lives. I think one of the reasons we reject gifts is simple fear. We're afraid. We don't know how to accept it. We don't know what it means. We don't know how to deal with it. I also think, two, there's guilt or shame. Maybe that narrative is, I don't deserve this. So we walk away, or we run away. This also spills over in insecurity or self-doubt. I'm not good enough. What if someone sees me for who I actually am? What if parts I don't like about myself are exposed? Number four, ignorance. We just don't know any better. Or we don't have the full picture. So in the case we don't know any better, maybe we grew up in a dysfunctional family where we never have really seen love offered unconditionally. Or maybe the flip side is we just don't have the full picture. We're thinking about Christmas and the larger gift that we're offered. Maybe it's ignorance. And finally, maybe it's simply complex pride, which I think is possibly at the root of all of these reasons. Fear, possibly guilt or shame, insecurity or doubt, because your voice in all these reasons is louder than anyone else's, and you let your voice be louder than anyone else's. And is this not also a little bit of pride when your voice gets to be louder than anyone else's? Tim Keller, when he applies pride to the Christmas narrative, writes this: Christmas is about receiving presents. But consider how challenging it is to receive certain kinds of gifts. Some gifts, by their very nature, make you swallow your pride. Imagine opening a present on Christmas morning from a friend and it's a dieting book. Or then you take off another ribbon and a wrapper and you find another book from a friend called Overcoming Selfishness. If you say to them, thank you so much, you are in a sense admitting, for I am indeed fat and obnoxious. In other words, some gifts are hard to receive because to do so is to admit that you have flaws and weaknesses and you need help. There has never been a gift offered that makes you swallow your pride to the depths of your being than the gift that Jesus Christ requires us to do. Christmas means that we are so lost, we are so unable to save ourselves, that nothing less than the death of the Son of God could save us. That means that you're not someone who can pull yourself together and live a moral and good life. To accept the true gift of Christmas, you have to admit you're a sinner. You need to be saved by grace. You need to give up control of your life. And that is descending lower than any of us really want to go. He says it another way, which I'll paraphrase. It's admitting that you're more flawed than you ever wanted to believe, but you're more loved than you ever dared hope. So really, at the end of it, we only want to accept the love we think we deserve. We didn't know that something could be better, so we go back to picking what we know. We don't think we deserve to be loved, so we run away when it's offered to us. We are worried that someone is too good for us. We think we deserve less, so we walk away. We accept the love we think we deserve. Because in all of those reasons listed above, fear, guilt, shame, insecurity, doubt, ignorance, and pride, the voice that is the loudest in that type of relationship is the one receiving the gift. But what if Christmas really was about gift receiving, more so than gift giving? Perhaps the bigger invitation of Christmas is that we allow the voice of the giver to be louder than our own. Perhaps we need to silence ourselves and receive from others. We accept the love we think we deserve unless we allow other voices to speak more loudly into our lives than our own, though what we get from them may not be what we think we need or want. So perhaps what we are missing out at Christmas with gift returns is that we actually allow our friends and family to give us what they think we need and not what we think we need or want. No more gift rejects, no more gifts returned, only gifts accepted. To let the giver speak more loudly into our own hearts and lives than our own voice. So that when we look back to the story of Jesus' genealogy, instead of seeing people who were rejected, who were set aside, we instead understand that they were actually set apart and they were accepted by God, the giver. And instead of seeing Mary and Joseph as two teenagers who were set aside and rejected by their friends and family, we actually see them as set apart by God for a special purpose. And instead of seeing the shepherds as set aside and rejected, we actually see them as accepted and invited to share the good news of the Christmas story. And Jesus himself, he was rejected so that we could be accepted by God himself. And so that instead of being set aside, we're invited to be set apart. Instead of being rejected, we are invited to be loved. The question we have to ask ourselves is, will we have the courage to accept this gift? So this morning, if you are a Christ follower, if you have said yes to Jesus, maybe there are areas in your life you're wondering if God has forgotten you, or you feel like you've been set aside. Things you hope for, dream for, being hurt. I wonder if maybe Christmas might be a reminder that you've been actually set apart for a purpose. You've not been forgotten, you've been forgiven, and you are remembered. That you have a purpose in his plan. And if you haven't yet chosen to follow Jesus, don't accept the love you think you deserve, because you deserve a whole lot more. So maybe the courage you need this morning is to just accept the love that God knows you deserve. Let him show you. Because I think that the question that wallflower asks the teacher at the end, when he says, can we make them know that they deserve more? Mr. Anderson responds with, we can try. I think that's kind of what God does every Christmas, maybe every day. I'm going to let love be sung from all the radios. We're going to hear Hark the Herald. We're going to hear Joy to the World. Be reminded that the Christmas story is actually a story for us all. We have not been set aside. We have not been rejected. But we've been set apart and accepted. That's the Christmas story. Let's pray together. Lord, we come before you, and I think we just need to confess that at times we have let our own voices be louder than yours. So if there are areas in our life where we are living out of lies that say we don't deserve you, that we don't need you, we don't want you, we're scared, help us to remember that's actually you who knows us better than we know ourselves. That you accepted us by taking on our rejection. And so, Lord, if there are areas in our life that we need to confess to you, that we have given those lies permission to speak louder, just take them away from us. And let in the season of Christmas your invitation to be accepted and to be loved by you, to be invited into your story, to be set apart, not set aside. Help us to remember that in these next 10 days. And so, Lord, this morning, as we leave this place, as we hear carols sung from the radio, as we step into a season of gift giving, help us also to be good gift receivers. When we open ourselves up to being loved by our family and friends, but also being loved by you when you show us what we really need, and maybe deep down we always wanted, but we just didn't know. In your name we pray. Amen. Let's stand as we respond.